inside of 24 hours, a sweet young thing from Smith and going into her senior year, thinking about, taking on student militancy, stayed around after a summer internship. We called President Mendenhall, whom I knew, and I said, how about letting this gal stay down here? I'm teaching a seminar at Princeton on the side. She can join that. And by the way, the Princetonians loved that. And she didn't mind either. One girl and 15 men at that age level is pretty good. She can go that, and she can write a term paper, whatever you have to do to settle your guild conscience up there. But Mendenhall then talked to his deans and faculty, and he, being of kindred spirit, produced for this girl now a half year off campus with full credit. I've got two MIT planners who cut out this fall, and they are doing responsible work for us. Trouble is, the more important the institution, the less, more difficult it is to get them to bend. So the MIT guys have had to do this without academic credit. But they're going back to organize the graduate students against the faculty to get this credit. Now, what are the aims? I think you've caught the aims. First, the aim is to establish some roles and to legitimize roles for young people who sense that this is the role that they want. It's in our generation. They need these, but they haven't been created. They don't want to surrender quite so early to one institution and one loyalty, and they are ready for this kind of an interim step. Not only that, but in the Native community, you begin to set roles for achievers, and achievers in two traditions. Terribly important, we found the black community to get black men in critically important spots of the black kids in the ghettos strive to become like them. Presently, they're striving to become like the hustlers. And the hustle is on in the ghetto, and the kids go with the numbers racket or whatever, or they learn how to deal with City Hall in a corrupt way. But when you put up legitimate roles, which are honored roles, you take along a whole trail of youngsters behind them. And I think, again, this is not to be a co-opting device. It's simply to say, right now, you get a lot of the natives, I'm sure, like our blacks and Puerto Ricans, who are going into the service. And they learn what the wide world is about, and they come back, and they become either an irritant or a yeast in that community. But they're never the same. I'm just saying, let's go beyond the military experience as a device of doing this. The military experience, by and large, is not a good way to expose some of these communities to the outside, because they're coming back bitter about many of their experiences and what they've run into. And there's been no follow-up for their role. That is, if they are not looked to, they're lost as a group. But let's create a role and also a symbol of integrity. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. I've discovered that if you take a young college kid, or forget college, somebody who is ripe for this kind of development, and put him up next to a senior citizen who is exercising power, whether it's Roger Blau at the U.S. Steel Corporation, or whether it's a mayor of a town or a legislator, that guy begins to act out a role which makes him be a hero in the eyes of this kid. And I have seen dishonest public officials take on kids and become honest because they had to survive that criterion. And I have seen also inefficient public servants goaded into efficiency to show those kids how good they really are. Now, once in a while it doesn't work. One of the kids got assigned this summer to a city manager, a town manager, who was in a community in the last on the stream that was flooding. And this town manager forgot to pull the plug, and it flooded his town. Now, he was in trouble, but as our intern reported, the reason he was in trouble was because he ran a canoe concession. And rising waters were good, so he just carried a little bit too far, and it turned out to be bad. Well, this kid made sure they pulled the plug the next time around. Two, to release the energies of our younger generation. And I need say no more about that, really to give them a constructive outlet. Third, to fight for Alaska's mine. And fourth, to bargain for Alaska's welfare. These people that you invest in are going to pay off to you not 5 years or 10 years from now, The point of diminishing returns might well set in at that point. They're going to pay off immediately. And if you need proof, let me give you a few examples. I'm now going to talk very personally. Cliff Goldman, 26 years old, on my staff. Kid out of the Jewish community of New Jersey, Rutgers economics undergraduate, Princeton Woodrow Wilson, Venezuela for an experience in helping building that new community with their oil revenues. Back to New Jersey to work in the governor's office on model cities. Came over to work as my troubleshooter, bright young guy. He almost single-handedly got the Meadowlands legislation through the legislature by doing staff work that talked to the legislators' interest. And when the legislators themselves and the governor despaired, on Friday night, he spent the weekend with individual legislators telling them why this thing ought to be put together and how they could bargain out a compromise. When it went through, the first time in 200 years we've been able to do this, I looked around and there was nobody else to run the thing for the time being than Cliff. And so I put Cliff into this job. Cliff is now responsible for this $3 billion enterprise. He has David Lilienthal working for him. He has Zurn Industries working for him. He has Tony Downs of Chicago Real Estate Research Corporation working for him. He's got Dick Babcock, the best zoning land use lawyer in the country, working for him. He is working with, sort of off the record, we have to take a look at the Mafia too as a system and understand this, because they're in garbage collection. We've got a captain and his crew out of West Point who are analyzing the underworld syndicate as it affects our credit and garbage operations, so that when we bargain, quote, on that side with the landfill guys and the rest, we can game the situation knowing that if we do this, they can do this, we can do this, they can do this, right on up the line. This is Cliff Goldman. As I say, 26 years old. And when USD is now across the table from US Steel on a $250 million investment, and US Steel has had to change its whole behavior pattern from how do we quick run in and exploit this development against a state bureaucracy that doesn't know its way around, into dealing with it on the merits. And interestingly enough, that U.S. Steel proposal gets better and better as they are forced to go get experts that can contend with ours, as a result of which I think we're going to have a much better development in that area than we would have ordinarily. Let me give you another one, Tom Cecil. Tom is another one of those Princeton Woodrow Wilson graduates who went up to the poverty program in New Haven, became assistant director. We brought him down to work at housing. He didn't know a damn thing about housing. For 6 months, I lived a very rocky existence because he grew kind of emotionally defensive as he didn't know quite how to deal with it, and those Sharpies out there in the development business were on him. And you know how you can be taken in this business, but fast. And particularly, the marginal operators usually try to get you first. Well, 6 months he learned the business, and now Tom Cecil is one of the best housing experts in the country. And I watched this guy get tough with a marginal operator the other day who is going to do the usual thing, which is hook you for a mortgage commitment and then set the specifications and then come in pleading that you couldn't meet the contract price and you got to change the specs. And more the specs get downgraded until you're building brick walls with a brick facing that folds out like this, but somebody else by this time has got to pay the bill. Tom sits down with these guys and bargains very hard. He went down to Washington and he picked off a $115 million commitment of 236 monies, which is far more than our share, but Tom Cecil has already produced for the state of New Jersey something between $150 and $200 million of assets that we wouldn't have had if he hadn't been in this position. Jim Alloway, a young guy of the same kind who became head of our division of local finance and looked at the fact that the local bond issues were being raided by guys in Wall Street who never had a chance to come out and take a look. So they talked to their guys in the club and said, hey, do you know anything about Essex Wells or something in New Jersey? And the other guy said, yeah. He said, 3 years ago, I had a friend who had a grocery store down there. Hey, tell me what it's like. Well, kind of a hell of a place. Bond rating, BA. you know. Now that's oversimplifying a bit, but this is the way it does begin to happen. What Jim said, look, simple. Went over to Wall Street and picked off a guy who works in Wall Street to work on the head of our debt management committee. And these people now go around to small municipalities and go through the business of preparing brochures, take them into Wall Street, introduce them to the financiers. And then, inside of 3 months, they'd save $5 million just in getting bond ratings which were lower or maintaining bond ratings which were going to be lowered in this particular issue. You can do this. In the data processing, he also saved us a lot of money because every one of our municipalities was being hit by the hardware guys. You know, we're going to sell hardware no matter what, without a program or with proprietary programs which were, did not talk to each other. And Jim said, stop. And we got our own experts out of the Bell Labs to begin developing the software program, the program that would talk to each other and answer our questions when we had to make decisions at the state level. Terribly important now because our state legislature needs to know the relative efficiency of this community is against that, how much is being spent, what will happen if they change the tax formulas by this amount. Let me give you another one, and this will not surprise you. Don McNaughton, president of Prudential Life. Don, I discovered one day when we had to do a certain kind of business in the ghetto, and against his own harder-headed guys in his own shop, Don was one of about 6 assistant banking commissioners in New York who have gone out since that experience to become private operators. Don McNaughton is a guy who sees things in the round. Literally, in 30 seconds, I can do business with Don McNaughton. He understands exactly what my problems are, and I understand what his are. Example, his real estate guys, whom we went tandem on a development of a housing development, they bought our bond issues with their billion-dollar investment program. We were building into the ghetto, and his guys wanted to cream the market. That is, they wanted to take only the blacks who were 10% of the population. They wanted to keep them at 10%, so this could be kind of a white, middle class, return to Newark, make it strong, economic base kind of stuff. We had to put blacks in there at lower income levels because there was no housing for relocation. And when I discovered that his guys and the real estate fellows were beginning to play games with the people coming in, that is, the black person came in and they said, they asked how much the rent, they'd tell them what the rent was. And they say, can't it get lower than that? The black would say, no. Well, except if you want to go on welfare. And then the black would say proudly, you know, I don't want to go on welfare, and they'd go out. The facts were that the rent had been arranged proportionate to income. And if they had just said to those black people, what is your income? This is what the rent is. No further nonsense. And it isn't a handout program. I get subsidized for my housing because I deduct my taxes and my mortgage payment, my mortgage interest payments from the Internal Revenue Code. Far more subsidies go to my economic level than that. But to me, it's regarded, you know, it's legitimate. To the black, in this case, not. So Don McNaughton very quickly said, change the real estate agent, put some sensitive people in there, do this, and that was it. It's terribly important to have a person of this kind. And let me give you another one. Junius Williams, I talked about yesterday, the black Yale law graduate, who has really, he and the guys that he's working with, begun to do the advocacy planning that makes so much sense. Instead of the black group coming in to bargain with, let's say, Milt Wieser of Mutual Benefit or myself, not having done their homework, they feel suspicious. They're sure we're going to take them. And they don't have any good advocates to do the bargaining. So they begin going extraneous routes, emotionalism, radicalism, the ritual of jumping up and hollering or whatever. Give them or let them have the advocacy role, first-rate lawyers, first-rate real estate operators, architects, medical people, and then we get into the time-honored contract arrangement where you get down quickly to essentials and you bargain out in those terms. I'm not saying it solves everything. There's a lot of noise around the bargaining table, but it is important to have that kind. And let me mention one last one, Bill Brennan, the son of the Supreme Court Justice, who was a corporate lawyer in Wall Street, and when I took this job, he ran after me one day into a subway in New York and said, should I come to New Jersey and work as a lawyer in the Attorney General's office? And I said, yeah, and for waiting for that subway train in 2 minutes, I argued to Bill why it would be important in his development to come into this sector for a period of time. Bill came in, and Bill is the guy. Last year, nobody else in the state would say it, but Bill makes a speech in which the older generation says, well, probably not very wise, very brash young man. He said, too many of our public officials are too comfortable with the racket. And all hell broke loose in New Jersey. And they tried to put him aside and bury him and, you know, try to get his father to talk to him. But this kid blew the whistle. And when he blew the whistle, a year now of change in New Jersey is taking place. Led to kind of now by Attorney General Mitchell, the local district attorney, and this morning I noticed 50 indictments in my state of guys who've been operating with the mafia, either on one side or the other. It took one kid, who at this time is, what is he, 25, 26, to blow the whistle. A year ago, New Jersey was a bum. Today, you should see the headlines. Brennan, you know, beatified. Apparently, everything that he said was wrong last year turns out to be right. Well, I'm not saying that Alaska needs to have the whistle blown. I'm not saying Alaska needs to have housing or the exact form that we've had it. I'm just saying to you one thing. I don't know really with confidence what else I could recommend to you of institutional change or whatever. All I can do is recommend to you the kids that I've worked with. Thank you very much.
All of these things would be defined as neutral, and as I presently see, argue that our systems that we have are not by any means neutral in this sense, and they're not neutral in a positive way. I mean, the unneutrality is not a favorable thing. Now, there are only three types of revenue measures that come pretty close to satisfying this standard. One is taxation of personal incomes, which in Alaska, by United States standards, has a high state income tax. I think this is good, not bad. It's good, certainly, from the standpoint of dealing with the problems that I talked about yesterday of the equalization of economic well-being and opportunity. It is good in the sense that the yield grows rapidly as the economy grows. I think the fact that you have historically gotten into a situation where the state defends fairly heavily on a high income tax is a positive feature of the tax system. Now, this doesn't mean that one should try to construct a tax system which is exclusively concerned with soaking the rich. For one thing, as I'm sure you all appreciate, what you do in effect in a state income tax or any state and local taxes when you try to sock the rich very hard is you in large part just offset federal tax liability. That is the state tax is deductible against federal income tax, and you're really just transferring money from the federal treasury to the state, which may be fine, but it isn't from the standpoint of you're not doing much to equalize opportunity. You can't feel very self-righteous and that you're really doing a great job of solving the problems of inequality of incomes and inequality of well-being by saying we'll concentrate on taxing having high rates on the rich. What you have to worry more about is how you're taxing the poor, whether whether your tax structure is good in that account. And I think any income, any tax can be improved. Even your present personal income tax could be improved in that regard. That is, there are all sorts of possibilities for adjusting the tax at the bottom end. But it's a good instrument, and it's a good foundation stone for the system. Now, another type of tax, another type of revenue instrument, which meets the standard of neutrality, would be taxation of land values. Taxation of land values is neutral and economically neutral compared to when I say neutral, I mean compared to having no tax at all. How does it affect behavior? Not compared to the present tax system, but compared to no tax at all on that object. Now, taxation of land values is neutral because it doesn't compare to no tax at all, because when you put a tax on land values, you don't affect any you should not affect the decisions on how the land is used. If the most profitable use of that land remains the same before and after the tax. If the most profitable use of the land is to put up a store building, talking about urban land, land in a central business district, put up a two-story store building on that land, the fact that you're then imposing a tax on the value of the site itself doesn't make it any more or less profitable to do that, to have a building on that site, a building of that character. Moreover, a tax on the value of land in no way raises the cost of that structure, of putting up that structure, or doing business or carrying on any activity. The tax on the value of land is a tax on the landowner himself. It is a tax that he can't shift forward to anybody else. It's not like a sales tax or gross receipts tax or something of that sort, which can be shifted forward in higher prices. It can't be shifted forward in higher prices because if an individual landowner attempts to just think now of a separation of ownership of land and buildings. Suppose all land is held by people called landowners, and none of them all own buildings. They just lease the land for buildings for various uses. If a tax on land is increased, an individual landowner may very well try to recoup the higher tax in the form of increased rents. But suppose the prospective user says, "I won't buy this. I will go somewhere else. I will find an alternative site where the rent is lower." The landowner can't bluff on this. He can't reduce production. You see, if you're a manufacturer and you're high tax is put on you, you can cut back on that on production, or all manufacturers collectively can cut back on production. Therefore, making those goods or services, if it's a service industry, more costly, scarcer, and therefore the price will rise. You can't extinguish the land. The land remains there. All the landowner can do is hurt himself. He can simply say, he can do something as irrational as saying, if you won't pay this rent, I will instead keep the site vacant and I will have no income at all. People just don't behave in large scale with that kind of irrationality. At least not landowners, because there's very substantial evidence that landowners tend to be the of all economic groups in the United States, the closest to economic man there is. They're very effective maximizers of their economic chances, and they do just very quickly. Well, if the tax does this, if a tax on land value, that is, if it has, doesn't change the most advantageous use of sites, doesn't raise costs, simply reduces land values, then it is neutral. But it has a special character in concept neutral, but it also puts landowners in a cash bind. That is, they've got to have, you put on a tax where there's been no tax before, or you raise an existing tax, landowners must raise money, additional cash, to pay those taxes. And therefore, it produces a short-term pressure to use land more effectively. It's a tax. It tends to work against speculative withholding of land from use. Now, should probably even start it off this way, distinguish here between, really urban land or land that has already been shifted to private ownership from the future use of the public domain. It's quite obvious that if one had whopping taxes on land whenever it was turned into private mm-hmm. ownership throughout the state, there would be very serious pressures to develop the land, and you might very well be foreclosing the conservation versus development issue. I don't think that what I'm talking about here, land value taxation, makes sense, except in dealing with the question of urban land. You can protect the non-urban land by tenure rules and provisions in leases and in transfers, which would tend to restrictions on use of land in covenants and would tend to reduce the market value of land, keep land value taxes low, or else you could simply talk about land value taxes as confined to specified urban areas within the state. But in looking at it just as an urban phenomenon, the point I think to be emphasized here is that I talked earlier about land, yesterday, about land, the importance of land use. And I think you have to recognize that a city, an urban area, really has just two things as its stock and trade. It's got its people with their talents and its land surface. That's all it's got to live on, and the future of the place depends on how those two resources are deployed. From its own resources. Of course, you can always improve the future of a city by giving it great gobs of additional funds from outside sources like oil revenues. But to the extent that the place is on its own, what it's got to do, maximize or use most effectively, are its people and its land surface. And despite the vast size of the state, it is not, I don't think, the urban portions of the state, the cities, can be indifferent as to effective use of land. You've got places like places in the southeast where you really are just have very serious physical limits on the amount of land that the city has available because it's so hemmed in by the mountains. But even aside from that, you've got questions of what it costs to extend the physical dimensions of the city, what it costs to spread out. Low taxes on land or no taxes on land not only encourage speculative withholding, they encourage, they tend to go with low density development with what is usually referred to as urban sprawl. This is, of course, a real problem where problem with providing urban type services, especially where none now exist. Now, all of this is put in terms of, I've been putting this in terms of higher taxes on land values in the abstract compared to low taxes on land and assuming nothing else. But actually what we've got here in Alaska, as in every place else in the United States, is we've got relatively low taxes on urban land combined with somewhat higher taxes on buildings. The property tax that, without exception in the United States, the effective rate of the property tax is higher on buildings than on land, despite what the law requires. In the Census of Governments study of done in 1967, in which this is a nationwide study, the figures for Alaska are this. This was a study in which the actual properties actually sold were examined and compared. The sale price was compared to the assessment of that property, this real property. And so this is not a guess as to what the value of the property is. What did it sell for? Well, ratios of assessed value to average ratios of assessed value to sale price were computed for various classes of property and for all states and for states for larger metropolitan areas. For the state of Alaska as a whole, residential property was assessed at about 86% of market value, vacant lots about 66% of market value, and outlying property described in acreage rather than lot terms at about 50% of market value. These disparities are characteristic of the whole country. It seems to be almost inherent in the kind of assessment process we have that tends to be undervalued, underassessed. What that means is that what the property owner confronts is you improve land, you improve the property, you improve your building, you build a bigger building, you increase your tax liability. You sit on your land and do nothing with it. You run it as a parking lot, speculatively withhold it. You have the minimum kind of building on it. You keep your tax liability down. I think that this just makes absolutely no sense. I think it makes no sense from the standpoint of the shape of the cities. It makes no sense from the standpoint of how housing, the effects on housing costs. That is, housing is the thing that tends to be to suffer from this. Have a better quality house, you pay more in taxes than you would otherwise do. Heavier taxation of land values than is now the case, or heavier taxation of land values than building values, is an old argument. As a matter of fact, this is the 100th anniversary of the publication of Progress and Poverty by Henry George, which was the start of the movement towards heavy taxation of land values. And it is a fairly common thing in the English-speaking world outside the United States. In Australia, New Zealand, Western Canadian provinces, British Columbia in particular, land values are taxed more heavily than building values. There the state of Hawaii does this now, just began doing this, and there are a few cities in the lower 48 that have in relatively recent years adopted the same principle. Well, let me move on from this, and I'm going to go back, we'll recap it again. Another element, a third element of a system of taxation, which or revenue raising, which is more or less neutral, is the application of charges for services, user charges. If the charge is actually a direct quid pro quo for the service, that is, if you get what you're getting in return for the service, then the user charge no more affects choices on investment and consumption location than does the price of bread or any other private price. You don't buy bread or any service offered in the private market if you don't think it's worthwhile. It's not if you don't think it's worth the price. I mean, the essence is that voluntary exchange takes place only if it's mutually beneficial to both purchasers and the sellers. Taxes, in contrast, are compulsory exactions, which may the payers of the tax may not consider the public services that they're getting worth the price. Well, user charges, appropriately designed user charges, and I discussed yesterday, spent some time discussing the design of user charges, but appropriately designed user charges are like prices in the private sector. They involve voluntary exchange, and they do not involve distortions. In fact, the failure to employ appropriately designed user charges where they can be employed is unneutral and distorting. The failure to have an effluent charge for a polluter encourages a polluter to locate, may encourage him to locate in a place where he imposes heavy costs on everyone else rather than a somewhat more remote place where he may impose no costs on anybody else. Now, in a sense, those three elements, user charges, the personal income taxation, land taxes, are the major ingredients of a neutral kind of revenue system. Of course, oil revenues also have something of this neutral character. They're something like land taxes, and particularly when oil revenues that come for bonuses from the auctioning of leases, is that really what's happening is the oil producers are sharing part of the surplus they get above and beyond the return that's needed actually to make the investment in the first place. They're sharing some of their advantage with the state. It's sort of like the rent of land. So that in a sense, taxation of or raising money from natural resources in this form has the same character as rental lands. It is part of the neutral system. Now, one could also have some taxes on consumption as part of the package of non-distorting taxes. The trouble with that is that you have to make sure that those taxes are pretty equal in their impact on all forms of consumption. And that's the one thing we outstandingly do not do. You don't do it in Alaska. We don't do it anywhere. We tend to have markedly different taxes on different uses of the consumer dollar. And everywhere, liquor and tobacco and gasoline tend to be heavily taxed, and that may be good or bad, but that's sort of a common consent and goes back a good many years. The one thing that we have blundered into, I think, and is not a matter of deliberate choice, is that one of the things considered a necessity, an essential part of life, is taxed at extremely heavy rates, more heavily than anything but liquor, tobacco, and gasoline, and that's housing. It's done not through a sales tax, but through the property tax. If you convert property tax rates into sales tax equivalents, that is, look at what people pay in property tax as a percentage of what they spend currently in cash for housing, for mortgage payments, for insurance, and so on. One finds that in the characteristically in the country as a whole, it's equivalent to about a 25% sales tax on housing expenditure. And my quick calculation for Alaska, which is, I find somewhat untrustworthy because of the data were not very recent, but I would guess it comes to about 15% sales tax, much lower than the country as a whole, but still 15% sales tax on housing, on current expenditure for housing. If you use a dollar of consumer income for housing, you tax it at the rate of 15%. If you use it for many other things, you're subject to no state or local tax at all. Use it to other things, you have taxes in the range of 3% or 3.5% or whatever the rate is. But you're not, nothing except liquor and tobacco and gasoline have anything like these massive taxes. Now, I can't believe that if we were starting over again to construct a tax system, and I think in Alaska you are in a position where you can practically start over again, that we would ever have a system in which there is anything like this exceedingly heavy taxation of housing. What you'd probably do if you're starting from scratch deliberately, you'd say housing probably should be exempt. It should be treated like food. Housing shouldn't be subject to extra heavy taxes. It should be subject to extra light taxes. And I think one can argue strongly that this is supported by the fact that when you tax housing more heavily, people consume, spend less on it. There is some price response to this, and this is most. But of course, this is not serious, given the fact that the property tax is deductible on federal income tax returns. This is not a serious problem for people in high federal income tax brackets. It's a serious problem the lower the income level is. Where the federal income tax deductibility isn't worth very much, in effect, the taxpayer, the property owner, is nakedly exposed to the full impact of the local property tax. If he happens to be a renter, of course, he's nakedly exposed, he's completely exposed, whatever his income level is. But in general, it seems to be just, again, if you were starting from scratch and said, let's think, how should we tax housing versus other forms of consumption? You might say, well, we'll exempt it completely. A fairly likely bet would be to say, well, we won't exempt it completely, but we'll try to let low-income people off the hook and tax housing expenditure somewhat more heavily at upper income levels on the assumption that there's more of a luxury character to that housing. Well, in effect, we do just the opposite as far as the burdens are concerned. High income people, they've got big property tax on it, but it's largely deductible on offset by federal income tax reductions. Low income people, big property tax burden, no offset. These are the elements of the revenues side. I have to talk, a fiscal strategy for state and local governments has to address itself to the relationships among the levels of government and how the responsibility, the fiscal relationships, and how the responsibilities for public services are allocated. Now, an abstract answer is to say one would allocate responsibility between state and its local units, the financial responsibility, the administrative responsibility, in relation to substantially on the basis of the geographic spillovers, that is, how if an activity is really has statewide consequences, you assign it to the state. If it has consequences that are very, very narrow indeed, confined to a very small local geographic area, you assign it to the local unit, and you don't use any state money to pay for it. You let the local unit pay for it itself, because otherwise you encourage people to spend money for more services than they really want, because it's cheap to do. However, I think that as I suggested yesterday, that if one looks at the Alaska situation, you see, well, there's an awful lot of public services that really don't have these kinds of geographic spillovers because of the big separation of the centers of population from each other. But in view of the equalization needs, I think there's a strong case for more statewide action than would one would find in a lot of other places. And this, of course, is especially valid where the revenue source can't be a trace to any particular local. It's not the property of any local government. When you're talking about natural resource money from natural resource endowments, it doesn't belong to a local unit. It's the property, really, of the people of the state as a whole. Another issue, too, in deciding on what level of government should do what is the level of government at which entrepreneurial energies can be most effectively applied. This differs considerably over time and in different places. I think it's quite clear from Paul Ilvesacker's presentation here that there's no question that in the state of New Jersey, it's been at the state government level in the past 4 years that has been a place where you can really apply entrepreneurial energy, innovation, et cetera, to get things done. In some other circumstances, this has not been the case. You can at all attribute this to local governments. I suspect that in Alaska, there really is a need on this score for a lot of state government action. Reading that draft by Vic Fisher and his associates, I think that it reinforces that view that this is where this is the arena for doing this. But of course, there is a case for self-financing urban local governments in the more populous areas to deal with distinctively urban-type services. And particularly when we're talking about things that are not developmental in character, things that are really amenities. I go back to the highway case in George Rogers' book. And you see, there need not have been any. Suppose we had, if you had a highway program as you did at that time, consisting of the large dollar part of it was improvement of highway facilities in the Anchorage area. There need be have been no argument about the program if the program were if entirely a function of Anchorage local governments, whatever they are, whatever they would be. If you had a local government jurisdiction that was empowered to raise money and spend it and plan a system of this kind, that would have been perfectly appropriate. What was inappropriate at that time was for a state which on the whole was, as George Rogers put it, a pauper state, to be financing something which was almost entirely an amenity for residents of the Anchorage area. Now, of course, how you decide on the allocation of functions has a lot of implications for which taxes to emphasize. But in any case, there will be a big state role here because of the oil money. I don't really, you could have, as I said yesterday, a big local revenue sharing scheme, but I don't really see this as a first priority, especially if the major, purely local responsibilities are limited to urban-type services that urban local governments, armed with taxes on land, with the sales tax power that you have in Alaska now, with user charges, could finance themselves. But, of course, there is a lot of things to do with the money. Paul Ilvesacker talked a lot about it. You've been talking about it all along. Things that have statewide implications, things that and particularly the emphasis on innovation and institutional development. I'm getting these warnings here to wind up. So I'm going to really close by reemphasizing something else, that this problem of just not allowing yourself to drift in designing fiscal strategy into doing into the mistakes that other people have made, into heavy taxes on housing. Paul yesterday spoke about the property tax in New Jersey as being such an impediment to doing anything about that. And in states like New Jersey and New York, the sales tax on housing, the sales tax equivalent rate, is not 15%, it's not 25%, it's more like 35%. Just a massive distortion of housing decisions. Moreover, this heavy reliance on the property tax greatly impedes the effort to do anything about housing problems through governmental action, since typically publicly assisted efforts in housing involve some kind of tax abatement or tax exemption. If your local government is depending heavily on taxes on property taxes and property tax on housing, the acceptance of external assistance to do something about the housing problem is likely to make their fiscal position worse. They're likely to say, no, we don't want any more. We can't tolerate any more of this publicly assisted housing, because I'm not talking about just public housing, but all sorts of public programs. We just can't tolerate that, because it will just make our fiscal situation worse. Moreover, I would say, repeat the warning against socking it to businesses and on the assumption that all taxes on businesses are exportable. And in dealing with the question of the intergovernmental structural system, I would not only worry about the state government's leadership, but I think I'd worry about allowing yourself to drift into a situation in which the local government structure you have, which started off in the Constitution as being such a simplified, streamlined, sensible one, gets very ossified itself, and gets where you can't change it, you have no flexibility, and you build up a lot of fragmentation in the urban areas. You build up a lot of vested interest in retaining a system which seems to be going nowhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. I'm sorry.